the indispensable nation, the city on the hill, the greatest force for good in the world, all the platitudes we're told, and the greatest democracy in history, as we're told, is also the number one gun runner in the world.
Welcome to the Independent Riot Podcast, your home for free thinkers, independent believers, and radicals questioning the status quo. Our goal is to provide you entertaining, intelligent discussion around all of life's most pressing questions without hidden agendas or ulterior motives. So if you're too good for the bad, too bad for the good, and sick of people trying to convince you to join their preferred pyramid scheme this week, you've found your home. Now here's your host, Jim Duncan.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Independent Riot. Today's episode is probably the most controversial one that we've done so far, just in the fact that it gets to a very emotional, subjective topic for a lot of people, which is, what is patriotism? And what is the correct way to express that patriotism? That guy that you heard at the beginning is Major Danny Sershin, who is not only an Iraq and Afghanistan combat veteran, but he has also been a graduate of West Point, as well as a professor of military history at West Point. And now, coming from that illustrious, very serious military career and background, he has become a prominent anti-war activist. Danny has not only had his writing published in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Huffington Post, Truth Dig, The Hill, and many others, but he has also recently authored a book called Patriotic Descent, in which he relies on his on-the-ground combat experience and his extensive knowledge of military history and imperialism to argue that it might be time to reevaluate what we think of as patriotic. Now, like I said, this could be a very controversial show because you might not agree with the same conclusions that Danny comes to about what patriotism is. But regardless, I think Danny's courage and wisdom is pretty undeniable, and he is raising some excellent questions, and I would just challenge you to think critically, analyze what your own belief in what being patriotic should mean. And I've got a few examples that I'd just like to throw out to you to help make you think a little bit about the concept. For instance, there's a lot of people who identify patriotism as in supporting a political party, either the Republicans or the Democrats. But just ask yourself, at what point do the members of that party, if they are acting in ways that are not beneficial to the country as a whole, at what point does your support of that party then become unpatriotic? Or another way to look at it is, obviously, I think a lot of us, most of us, all of us should ideally support all of the brave men and women that put on military uniforms to protect and defend our country. But does that necessarily then mean that you've got to support any military action by the United States, regardless of the justification or motivation for that military action, especially when it puts those troops that you are supporting in harm's way? I'm not saying that there's easy or straightforward answers to those questions, and I doubt that Danny would say that he thought that either. But to paraphrase from his book, tyranny only exists with the death of nuanced thinking. I think it's important to think about these concepts for yourself and figure out what the principles are that you are actually supporting behind the flag. Because a little known fact is, for a lot of people, is that America has not actually been technically at war since World War II. That was the last time that we declared war. Yet since then, around 400,000 combat veterans have been killed or wounded for the United States. And we now have an epidemic of nearly 20 suicides a day across the country every day by veterans. So if we haven't declared war since World War II, yet we're suffering that many casualties from the brave men and women that put on the United States military uniform, what is going on? Why is that important? Because we should be deliberating and debating in public where we are sending our troops. And that's going to get us into a very interesting discussion about what the military-industrial complex even is. And if you've ever wondered what that term means, this is going to be the episode that you want to listen to, because Danny is going to break it down for us. Overall, it's a fascinating and informative discussion with a very smart and courageous guy, and it'll help you formulate your own ideas about what patriotism is or what it should be. And before we get into it, if you can, please subscribe to the podcast to make sure that you get all of our interviews. We've got these coming out every week, so you don't want to miss those. And if you'd like to help us put out additional independent content, please consider becoming a patron through the link in the show notes. That actually not only will help us out, but you also will get access to exclusive bonus video and audio content from every interview we do. We've got some behind the scenes footage with Danny up in the patron section, which is pretty entertaining. And as well, if you sign up at the highest tier, you also get a free Principles Over Parties t-shirt and a book. So please consider doing that. Helps us out a lot. And now, without further ado, the wise, the courageous, Major Danny Surgeon. What, from your perspective, was the real reason we went to Iraq? And then what was the real result of it? Are we safer now or not?
I mean, you know, in the Army, we always say BLUF, bottom line up front. Bottom line up front is, you know, the war was built on lies and we're less safe because of it. And we'll probably be less safe. Our kids' generation will probably be less safe still.
Okay.
Up though, it is instructive and illustrative at the same time that I went to West Point in July of 2001. I left New York City to do so. 9/11 happened when I was in boxing class my plebe year, and that emanated to some extent from Afghanistan. But my first war was Iraq. That is the pivotal point, right? And I'll explain why. But that is interesting. That is interesting. The war in Afghanistan was not over. It was dormant, but it was not over. And if the attack emanated from there and not from Iraq, it is interesting that not only me, but 90% of my classmates went to Iraq first.
Yeah.
90%. Okay. It was considered a diversion and a lucky thing to get sent to Afghanistan in 2005, 6, and 7 when we were all going, because I graduated in 2005. It was considered lucky because the violence was much lower there at the time. Now it got worse. And so it was almost silly. We thought it was like, oh, isn't that cute that, you know, Lieutenant so-and-so, our buddy from the rugby team, got sent to Afghanistan. Well, at least he'll keep his legs, you know, like dark humor. But we went to Iraq first. I didn't get there until October of 06. So it's 3.5 years after the invasion of Iraq. Now, the point is, by the time I got there, even though I was kind of vaguely still probably a Bush-supporting unregistered Republican,
yeah,
and even though I really still believe that the U.S. could and had been a force for good in the world, it was impossible, if you were even remotely informed or remotely a reader. And people forget this. Like, young people don't even remember the Iraq War. You know, waitress in a local bar was telling me, she's 18, she was telling me she didn't understand why we went to Iraq. She's like in a political science class, a freshman in college. And I said, oh, that's fine. Nobody does, you know?
Yeah.
But the point is, if you were vaguely informed, which it was hard not to be when you knew you were going to be at the forward edge of that policy, doubts had already started to creep in for most of us.
Sure.
My battalion, my squadron commander, Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Phillips, who turned out to be a really good guy, although I hated him at the time. I was wrong in many ways. He read Fiasco by Tom Ricks summer and fall as we were going in. And he told us about it. All the officers, he pulled us together. We went for a run, as you do. And then we had a little leadership chat afterwards, as you do. It's like our version of like corporate nonsense. And he said, listen, I just read this book by Tom Ricks, Fiasco. And it really shook my view of what we're about to do. And, you know, we still have to, he was having like a moment, really. It was hard to watch. He was like, I don't know. I mean, I have these doubts, and it was courageous of him to say it. But we still have to do this. And so let's try to make our little sector as good as possible.
And that's why you're already on the ground in Iraq.
We were in Kuwait getting ready to cross the border in C-130 planes. So we're like doing our final desert training, you know, and he told us that. So those doubts had creeped in for me. I had read Andy Bacevich's book, The New American Militarism. People should check out his work. He's a West Point grad and a Vietnam veteran who had a very similar path to mine. It shook me as well. And so I was having these doubts. And so I think by the time I got there, I already knew that there were no WMD. That was exceedingly obvious. I knew that Al-Qaeda had no real connection to Saddam, which was exceedingly obvious, even to the people, you know, looking for their staplers like Milton in the basement of the State Department, but nobody was listening to them, you know? So this was out there. This was known, just not by the public, just not by CNN at the time. But what was really shaking, and I was okay with that somehow, you know, look, we made a mistake, but we're here now. Let's spread freedom.
Yeah.
And then I think when I saw the human cost of that, because the Civil War was at its height in October and November of 06. In fact, November and December of 06, my first 2 months as an independent patrolling platoon leader, were the two bloodiest months for Iraqi civilians in the whole war.
Okay.
We're talking 5,000 dead civilians a month, murdered in the streets or killed in suicide bombs. Well, I picked up those bodies that were bound and shot in the back of the head in their streets, gangland style, and I handed them over to the Iraqi police. And it is for a certain type of person, maybe not for a stronger guy than me, but for me, for a certain type of person, that is an image that does not leave you. And then when you're a bookish person who decided to read every book on Iraqi history that you could find, and as policy and past, and you know, oh, gee, you know, my country's illegal and ill-advised invasion is the reason that this is happening. So that marrying, again, I'm going back to your first question, that marrying of theory and practice, it threw me for a loop. So I think when I realized that that was the case and I walked up as the first responder to suicide bombings in markets where there were children blasted through car windshields, babies, you know, anyway, I don't want to make too much of it, but it was someone quoted me the other day. I don't remember saying it, but I basically said that like it was like the pivotal shift in my life. You know, it was like that horror of the Iraq War. So by November 30th ish, it's weird to put a date on it, but I remember it. By the end of November, I was full throated, opposed to what we had done. Thought our best bet was to get out. That we were part of the problem. That so long as we were there, there would be a resistance, and I understood it. And that was that. Of course, I stayed in the Army for 13 more years, which is a whole other issue that I have a lot of penance to do for it, which is why I didn't sleep last night.
Yeah. So. Well, that, did our presence going into Iraq, you think that actually literally the destabilization of the government then caused that civil war between Sunni and Shia and set that off? So arguably we made the place less stable. Many more Iraqis died because of our involvement there.
Yeah. I mean, indirectly and some of them directly.
Yeah.
Depending on your point of view, it's about a million bodies on Bush's, you know, polite hands. I was on a date of all things. And it was right after Biden had been finally like anointed that he had actually won, you know, the states had come in that very day. And this intelligent woman said, an intelligent, educated woman said that at least Bush, unsolicited, said, you know, at least Bush loves his family and loves his country. In other words, he's better than Trump.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my head almost exploded. We almost had an intellectual murder suicide right there at the table, but I restrained myself. But I mean, that's the kind of talk you hear. But yes, I mean, we didn't necessarily hand the guns to the different sides and point them at the other sects. But when societies fall apart, right, conceptually and historically, the kind of worst elements rise, the sort of sociopaths and demagogues, existing tensions in a sectarian and divided society, especially an artificial state that's only at that point 90 years old and created by British imperialism, you know, all that comes to the fore. And, you know, we're still operating in the lizard brain. We're barely out of the jungle. Shut the power off in America for 72 hours and see what happens, let alone what happened in Iraq. So I think, yeah, of course, absolutely. We caused it. We should never forget it. It is one of America's historic crimes.
And one of the things, and again, like I'm a devout independent at this point and think it's sort of my duty to try and find the problems with both parties, if I can, and the label thinking, groupthink that's wrong with both of them. And it surprises me, like as you were saying on your date, how people, there's nothing more than foreign policy where it seems like people can intellectually disconnect from the facts for some reason and then assume their guys, the red or the blue team, is doing things correctly. And whether we're talking George W. Bush or Obama and drone strikes, isn't the reality most likely that we have created many more potential terrorists with all of those actions than we have ever stopped? Because if somebody's family gets blown up, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat doing it, those people are pissed. And you're going to be anti-American and much more likely to try and attack us if we have killed people that you love. And am I wrong in that assessment? Or is it?
I think you're raising something that's very important that I very rarely get to talk about, and I'm glad you asked it. When we had that discussion, we were sitting on the Kansas City Plaza, the wealthy upscale white shopping and restaurant district. War is more of an abstraction there and in places like that than anywhere else. And so you're correct to state, I think, that foreign policy is the easiest thing to maintain a distance from, to yeah. have a degree of sort of empathy ADD and to turn it into like a partisan point scoring. When one has not seen the what that looks like at the forward edge, right? When one, you know, and I'm not obviating myself of my own complicity in crimes. It's to say that it's easy for that to be distant. And so you can say things like, you know, Bush at least loves his family, whatever that even means. You know, you can feel it. Or you can say, hey, look, Obama was so great. I really liked his speeches. And Obamacare helped me, maybe, you know, yep. and I felt that. It was tactile to a certain extent. Whereas, you know, Obama's foreign policy, which we're about to see a revamp of, I fear.
Oh, yeah.
In the Biden squad, Obama's foreign policy sought to make war even more of an abstraction through tech-savvy solutions and using like advisors and proxies. But I can assure you that for the Yemeni child taking their last breath because they haven't had a meal in several weeks, or the bomb dropping on their school bus from the Saudi plane with American-made bombs that was fueled midair by an American jet, that it still feels a lot like war.
Yeah.
Like it may not feel like war in terms of as many caskets coming home to Dover, Delaware's air base. You know, there aren't as many American flag draped caskets during the end of the Obama years and even during the Trump years. But it feels a whole lot like war,
yeah.
whether it's a drone dropping the bomb or you're being starved by the blockade sanctions. So, look, I mean, most Americans talk a good game, but are focused on what they consider to be kitchen table issues. I was in the streets after George Floyd for that whole first month, like every day. And I was really hoping that seeing the police militarization, seeing the snipers on the roof of those same stores that I was eating in front of on the Kansas City Plaza, seeing drones above and camo clad and flak vest wearing and sniper positions up on the buildings. I was hoping that seeing that militarization would make people realize that, in fact, war has never been an abstraction. It's always come home like all empires do. And there was some talk of that. But I think in the end, places we can't even find on maps are just too distant. They're just too distant. So foreign policy, it's easy to make it into partisan point scoring because there's not as many stories of my grandmother really was affected positively or negatively by this healthcare policy or this social security policy. There's less of that.
Yep. Yeah. Now, this sounds like a good segue. And again, to to, because I want to make this accessible to as many people as possible, the concepts. Do you think you could explain to us, can you explain what the military industrial complex is and how forever wars or what we're doing currently has not always been in place as much as it is currently? How did we get to that point? And what is the military industrial complex and why does it keep on going? Why are we always at war now?
You know, again, in the bottom line sense, this industry is an industry full of humans who have pecuniary and professional interest in the continuation of either forever low intensity wars or drumming up, you know, multi-front cold wars that require an arms buildup, an arms race. That did develop over time as the United States became a more interventionist power crossing its oceans that had been considered to protect it up until the First World War. And as a permanent arms industry formed, right, that not only supplies our troops, but supplies, we're the number one gun runner in the world. I mean, the indispensable nation, the city on the hill, the greatest force for good in the world, all the platitudes we're told, and the greatest democracy in history, as we're told, is also the number one gun runner in the world. I mean, has to be said. So military industrial complex is complicated. You know, I have a theory that anything that has a hyphen in it becomes like too big and grandiose and abstract. People don't understand. But what it looks like in practice is actually human beings following human sort of frailties and ambitions. So you have a corporate defense industry that makes the bombs and the planes and the tanks. They seek to sell them primarily to the U.S. government. And also to foreign allies or partners, right? And as many as possible to increase the bottom line. One of the ways they make sure that there isn't a big cut in defense spending, thus driving their profits downward, is to employ former military officers, usually generals, and other civilian national defense people as either lobbyists or board members, because what they can then do is they run through what we call the revolving door from military service to corporate service. And then they lobby on behalf and they have that credibility of having been like an adulated soldier, because our society almost fetishizes soldiers at this point. So,
yeah,
but their former subordinates, the colonels, are now
still
they get promoted to general and they're in the positions of acquisitions where they decide what we buy and what we don't. And they tell the civilian bosses, their civilian masters, what to buy. Who are those civilian masters? Congress. Congress controls the power of the purse. So the last wing, or the other main wing of the military industrial complex, and Eisenhower, when he coined the term military industrial complex in his farewell address, when he originally wrote the speech, he wanted to say military industrial congressional complex, but he was convinced to kind of cut it, you know, for brevity. So those lobbyists, many of whom were former generals, one of whom became Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, under Trump. He had been a lobbyist for Raytheon and prior to that, a West Point grad, combat veteran in the Persian Gulf War. They lobby Congress. And so the defense industry sends these guys out to make their arguments, but they also fund their campaigns, Democrats and Republicans alike. And then they also take their industries that build these weapons of war, and they spread them across as many states and congressional districts as possible. So the F-35 fighter jet, which is a disastrous program, just overruns, cost, problems with maintenance, you know, that's built in what? About 40 states are involved in some part of the process of putting together one of those $90 million programs. So look, this is how they maintain the formula, as I call it, for forever war. And the output is that there is a tiny, tiny segment of people getting very, very rich off of these wars. But it is not my soldiers who lost legs, limbs, lives for about $30,000 to $40,000 a year. They didn't profit from it. And no one asked them to lobby for Raytheon. Turns out the limb losers don't make great lobbyists. The generals do.
That's one of the biggest things that I think is a disconnect with most Americans, and not only with the military part of that, but the incestuous relationship between corporations, lobbyists, and politicians, that until people get what's going on with that, it seems like it's going to be very difficult for anything to change. But like the Biden's Secretary of State, Anthony
Blinken. Blinken.
Is it? Yeah. His consulting firm, I believe, is called West Executive or West Exec.
It's called the West Exec Advisors for the West Executive Offices, because in the White House, all the people who founded and work there, the core group, came from the West Executive Offices in the Obama White House, trading on their experience to consult.
Yeah.
They're not even hiding it. These people are not subtle.
Yep. Yeah. It's just amazing that there is that. And people tend to think like, oh, well, there's laws and regulations to prevent that. But it's just a matter of formality. A lot of times it's like they're like with their group, I believe they're not technically lobbyists. They're consultants, which means they don't even have to disclose where their money and connections are on the back end. And that's the difference of like a form, whether you're a lobbyist or a consultant. It's not. So it's just, but you're what you were mentioning, the like the generals becoming lobbyists and then the colonels moving up to becoming like it's literally just a phone call away, that connection. It's still all there. Yeah.
Just to make people understand the military culture too, and I'll be really brief with this, but those relationships are still hierarchical and they still matter. Two examples. On Thanksgiving Day, my old first sergeant, who was my second in command, my senior enlisted advisor in Afghanistan, texted me to say Happy Thanksgiving. And we're friends. We get along. But it said, Happy Thanksgiving, sir. Well, yesterday I was catching up with my old boss, my old squadron commander, who I love and adore and is also a friend. I mean, I'm there when his kids have birthday parties. But and he's a general now. And when I say, hey, I wanted to check in with you and ask you this question, maybe we could talk soon. I say, sir, how's it going over there? The point is these relationships matter and they follow you after the military. That, you know, you spend 25, 30, 35 years in a hierarchical military culture. And those, so it's not just that they're friends. It's that they also defer to one another. So the former colonel who's now a general, he's probably still calling the retired 4-star who used to be his boss, like, sir, and showing him deference. So when that guy says, hey, would you like to buy what Raytheon has on offer? You know, you're more likely to say yes. It sounds cosmetic, but it's more. I can tell you that from personal experience.
Yeah, it's what's cosmetic seems to be the laws that are supposed to prevent it. That's the.
I may steal that. I will footnote you. I like that. That's the first time I've heard that. What's cosmetic is the laws. I like that. No, really. I mean, it's true. You know, the consultancy loophole is what they call it, which you're describing, you know.
Yeah.
Consultancies, what they do looks a lot like lobbying, but they twist the language enough to say it's not. And then we all just agree it's not. We all pretend it's not. And so you can say you're a consultancy. You just change the sequence of the consonants.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you get away with it. So big loophole. People die behind that loophole, by the way, American and foreign.
Yep. In all fairness, obviously, there's not the loss of life component, but that's just not regulated to the military industrial complex. That goes into pharmaceuticals, banking, every sort of corporate interest that has the money to be associated with those people. That's and it's prevalent across both parties is what people need to get, I think, is it's not just the Republicans or just the Democrats. It's all of Washington, D.C. functions that way.
It's part of the reason I'm big on the libertarian circuit. I mean, on foreign policy, we agree.
Yeah.
Libertarians look at this system and, I know just enough to be dangerous on the ideology. But the idea is like if what you're looking for is a frictionless free market economy of open choice, that's not what this is, right? This is like a crony capitalism. So whether you're a progressive who thinks that there needs to be like all kinds of regulation and stuff, or you're a libertarian who wants to see the thing operate without much, without much control, you can still agree that this is a corrupt and horrifying system. And that's why there is a nascent but real existing alliance that's growing between libertarian and progressive anti-war activists, because they see the same problem. They may come up with slightly different solutions in domestic policy or serious differences, but they can agree that this is corrupt. And you know what? The Trump people could agree.
Yeah.
A lot of Trump's base
sees
this as obscene. And when he would occasionally say the right thing on this, he very rarely followed through. I mean, his administration was like a nepotism and corruption factory. Yeah. Yep. But he said some great stuff that nobody would ever dare say.
Yeah.
That Obama wouldn't have said a lot of the stuff that Trump said about the generals and how they like war and they're involved in this corruption and the military complex. Nobody said that since Eisenhower. He didn't follow through. But the point is, isn't it interesting that a Trump-supporting populist and a libertarian, paleo, hardcore theory guy and a vague progressive can all agree on this? That's instructive.
Yep. And that's where I think if there is a positive trend into the future, it would be what I would hope is there is a more, it becomes populism against power centers, whether that power center is coming from a corporate structure or government overreach. Like, I think eventually all of those different ideologies can combine on populism, as in giving more people back to giving more power back to citizens versus anyone who would, any group that would capture it. It seems like that's something that people could agree on across the different labels and ideologies. I don't know if we'll get there or not, but that's where I could see it progressing in a healthy way, where all of those different groups can come together in agreement that, okay, we don't want a 1% of anyone controlling all of us, whether that's a corporation, corporate based, military industrial based, or government based. You don't want one group with an inordinate amount of power, whoever they are. So,
and not to sound conspiratorial, but it's demonstrable. If you were part of that establishment elite, liberal, urbane imperialist, or overt coarse imperialist, it might behoove you to divide those libertarians, progressives, and populists from one another by convincing them that they really have so much not in common on race, religion, cultural things. You might want to sow that discord. And if someone steps out of line on these dissenting debates, you may want to say that they actually are working for Russia. I mean, and this is what you start seeing. So someone like Tulsi Gabbard, and I'm not talking about Russiagate and all that, but like someone like Tulsi Gabbard speaks out against the war. She's a serving major in the U.S. Army National Guard and a veteran twice of Iraq. And she speaks out against it. And an ex-Secretary of State, two-time presidential candidate, says live on the air, says she's a Russian asset, which is accusing her of treason. I guess libel laws don't apply anymore. So this is, but the point is, it behooves you, if you're in that elite, if you're in that group that profits from it, it's very small but very powerful, then it does behoove you to divide the people. And it's worked. I mean, it's worked. It kept slavery going. It works historically and conceptually.
And that's where I think you alluded to, the conspiratorial mindset can get going, running with some crazy extrapolations off of that, of more dramatic scenarios that are very interesting stories. But the reality is, I think that a lot of that is driven simply off of greed.
Yeah.
That it's not a world controlling thing. It's wealthy, powerful people keeping their wealth, increasing their power, and looking out for their own self-interest explains all of it. And
I'm an Occam's razor guy. I do think that the simple solution, simple corruption and incompetence, usually describes it, not conspiracy.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't need the big bad boogeyman at the end of the story and all of that. It's just, if everybody is greedy and has the ability to do it, that takes care of it. And so could you, to take a little bit of a segue back, would you mind explaining, because I think this is another thing where we're talking about the disconnect on foreign policy. It fascinates me how little people are aware of how many places we are actively in combat right now, or as far as doing a combat might not be the actual correct term, but we are having some sort of military involvement on a regular basis.
Like the numbers and the scope and the volume is unprecedented historically. I mean, that is one area where America is indeed exceptional. It's exceptional all the wrong reason. We parse the language a lot, and unsurprisingly, liberals do this a lot. So administrations like the Obama administration are actually almost more prone to it. one of the things that Obama was really big on, was, you know, waffling and sort of vacillating on what's a combat troop, what's a boot on the ground.
Yep.
Like, that was a big debate. The idea being, well, advisors, combat advisors in Africa, they're not, those aren't combat soldiers. They're advisors. Ooh. Oh, okay. I worked with a lot of advisors. I saw advisors killed. I bet they thought they were in combat. What do advisors do? I mean, they arm, train, advise local proxy forces that sometimes commit war crimes, that even if they don't do that, they sort of end up like forever altering the system and having effects, right? This is combat. And when those four American Green Berets were killed in Niger, a country that even the most hawkish of hawks in the Congress, Senator Lindsey Graham, admitted initially he didn't know we had soldiers there or what we were doing there.
Wow.
Yep. If Lindsey Graham, who thinks that the world is a game of risk, doesn't know that we have soldiers in Niger or what they're doing, what hope does Joe the plumber have, to jump back to an old analogy? What hope does my mother have, you know, who's more focused on her COPD and her next rent check? It's understandable. I mean, I'm not pointing fingers per se. I just think that we have to realize the realities of this. But so what's the numbers? You see a lot of them thrown out. 800 military bases in 80 countries. That's the popular one. David Vine's book, Base Nation, is pretty good on this. You know, it depends how you count. Not all deployments are equal. Not all bases are equal. You know, some of these countries, we have a handful of soldiers that mostly live in an embassy. But what we do know is during the late Obama years and the early Trump years, on an average day, America drops a bomb in seven countries on humans. Okay.
Every day.
Most days.
Yeah.
Most days. But, you know, some days maybe it's four. But there are like seven countries we actively bomb. And again, this was an Obama and a Trump joint, you know, to steal from Spike Lee. This wasn't a Democrat or Republican thing. And then, you know, we have, depending on your count, between 20 and 25 countries where we're engaged in what would be considered combat, where we have like advisors or special forces that maybe not every day, but are there fueling, taking part in, sometimes dying in a conflict. That's an enormous amount, right? So let's say it's 25 countries, which is a pretty reasonable and mid-range estimate. Most of them are in Africa, by the way.
Yeah.
Most of them are in Africa. Most of them are in the African Sahel. They're mostly in the old Francophony French Empire, in fact, and almost no Americans have a single idea what those countries are called. Niger, Americans could not only not just not find Niger on a map, they couldn't pronounce it.
Yeah.
Like, new rule, like you're only allowed to have soldiers killed in countries you can both find on a map and pronounce.
Yeah.
Okay. And there were some really awkward pronouncements given the spelling.
Yep.
And so I just think this is important. How many Americans know that in January, Americans died in Kenya? How many people know that? It happened this January, 2020.
Yeah.
Three Americans, two contractors, and a soldier died in Kenya. You know, they don't know why. They don't know why. They don't know what happened even. They don't know what caused it. And the point is that what we've done is we've taken our tentacles of our military, we've put them everywhere, we've applied a military solution to every problem, and there's blowback. It's pretty simple, really. And the blowback and the policy is driven by that military industrial complex with the confusing hyphen that I'm trying to simplify for folks.
And now to try and provide like a devil's advocate looking at this from potentially other sides. All right. So with 21st century advancements in technology, such as not only nuclear weapons, the bombs, but dirty bomb capability and biological warfare, obviously threats have increased in how far geography doesn't stop a threat anymore like it used to. Like, you know, 100 years ago, if somebody was on the other side of the country or other side of the world, you could be fairly certain they weren't going to be able to kill you in Nebraska. Now that has definitely radically shifted with technology, that there's much more of an existential threat that doesn't have anything to do with geography. Is that a justification for our military involvement? Do we need some of that? Because I guess why is that part of, if we're looking for reasons why this might be a good thing that we're involved militarily around the world, is that it? Is that the real reason, or is it the military industrial complex people making money?
I mean, I do actually think it leans to the latter, but you still raise important points that have to be grappled with, because these are the arguments that are being made in the pages of Foreign Affairs by the likes of Jake Sullivan, right, who is going to be the National Security Advisor. I have a long analysis on him coming out tomorrow at SheerPost. Of course, it'll already have published when this comes out, but it's important to note, because those are the arguments being made. So if we don't take them seriously, we can't counter them. I don't think that the threats are existential. The existential threats to the United States are twofold. They are climate catastrophe and nuclear catastrophe, nuclear Armageddon.
Okay.
If that comes about, it'll probably come from a state-based source like Russia or China, and it'll be based on some sort of provocation or misunderstanding. Everything we should be doing should be getting at those threats. Unfortunately, aircraft carriers and tanks aren't very effective to counter either of those threats. Here's what I would say about it, though. Dirty bombs can exist, right? One can make one. One can get nuclear material. It's a lot harder than people think. Right. That's probably what hasn't happened already. It's not because our FBI and CIA are doing such a bang up job. Like, look at all the leaks from that. They're a mess. They always have been. It's a dirty world. It's tough. It's tough business. I'm not saying it's just their fault. A human being still has to want to do that. A human being still has to want to come to the United States, utilize the technology, utilize the travel and communications technologies that allow that to be the case. How does a person decide they want to die probably fighting America? Well, they get really angry based on some sort of U.S. policy. And they start to look beyond their village or beyond their ghetto neighborhood in an urban space, usually in Africa, the Middle East, and they're motivated to do it. What motivates them to do it, we've found, and the studies show this, there's empirical evidence from a variety of interdisciplinary fields that show us that it's usually U.S. policy that fuels it. Actually, forward basing of U.S. troops tends to catalyze anti-American sentiment. And supporting allies who do, you know, dastardly deeds, whether it's the Saudis or the Israelis or others, has the same effect. To wit, I'll just use one anecdote. There was this guy. There was this young, really, really, really privileged Saudi guy who his father was from Yemen, and he's this big, big billionaire. And two things happened in his lifetime that got him really, really angry at America. The first one was that U.S. troops got long-term stationed in his country, like, which was like the holiest of holy spots for Islam. And the second, so that was the overt U.S. basing overseas that really angered this guy and a lot of his friends. And the other thing that happened is in 1982, the Reagan administration greenlights an Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And in the process of greenlighting that Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the Israeli army encircles Beirut, the first and only Arab capital they've done this to. And they bomb the heck out of apartment buildings trying to root out the PLO fighters who've been shooting rockets ineffectively over their border. They start leveling apartment blocks. Over a thousand civilians are killed. There's this famous picture. A kid loses both arms and it's plastered all over the news. Israel never really recovers from that, you know, in terms of PR. And it's American bombs that are being dropped. And it's on TV every day. And this same Saudi guy, this super rich kid, is watching like the equivalent of CNN in the Middle East. And he sees these towers and he watches one of these apartment building towers come down with American bombs and an American green light diplomatically with top cover, even though it wasn't our planes dropping it. And he watches a tower come down. And he knows there's Lebanese kids in there, Muslims. And he says someday, he says later about it, he says someday someone needs to take some towers down in the United States. And that privileged Saudi kid was Osama bin Laden. And so, you know, if you'll forgive the narrative cliche, I think the point there is that when you put a human face, I could argue to abstraction all day. I could cite books and all that. But when you put a human face on it, someone has to want to come here. So that means that we have to be very, very careful about weighing the cost benefit and the counterproductivity of our military interventions overseas. There's been very little benefit. We've generally actually made places worse. That's demonstrable. And we should be very cautious about that. So, yes, there are threats in the world, but all threats are driven by a human motivation to actually do the deed. And I think that more often than not, we are actually causing folks to want to do the deed. And that doesn't make them good folks. I didn't like most of the kids in the Taliban killing my soldiers. I think they were monsters, a lot of them. And most of them were just idiots. I mean, they just didn't know any better.
Yeah.
I don't excuse their actions, by the way. You set off a suicide bomb in a market, even if I caused the war, even if I illegally invaded your country, I don't accept that.
Yeah.
But I also have to live in the world it is and try to, you know, try to weigh those costs and benefits. So, yeah, I kind of reject the argument, but I understand that it's the one that's going to continue to be made. So we have to take it seriously.
And this makes me remember a quote from your book that you put in there that I don't remember who it was that originally said it, but it definitely stood out to me that I'll paraphrase of tyranny is the deliberate removal of nuance, which struck me as not only in actual tyranny, but in the US with the way we have gotten so binary and politically polarized, thinking under red and blue labels and concerned more with the team winning than the actual nuanced policy discussion, that quote, I think, is relevant to modern America in the sense that we're never going to be able to, I don't think, get actual good responses to those extremely complex foreign policy military questions until we all stop thinking in terms of red and blue, as far as supporting, justifying the actions rather than looking at what's actually going on in the ground, because, like, again, they're both basically supporting the military industrial complex in these forever wars, yet people will tune out. And just when it's their side that's claiming they need to do it, they're like, yeah, go team, like, go. I'm being a patriot because the Republicans want to send people to Yemen or something. And it's scary that we can't discuss these things in actual nuance. Like, why are we there? Is that the best response? Are there alternatives? And so if you could wave a magic wand, I guess, and present a better way of handling this, like, what are kind of your ideas for potential solutions going forward of how we restructure this or think differently about it, whether it's what are the solutions for average Americans, but also the government? Like, what can we correct?
You know, just like problems and just like champions, you know, one's nemeses also are often red and blue alike. And so my self-styled, who don't care about me, nemeses right now are, you know, Mike Pompeo in the Trump administration.
Yep.
And new, you know, Jake Sullivan, a lot of these guys come in from the Biden bunch. And both of them would say of me and folks like me that we have all kinds of criticisms. We poke all kinds of holes, but we don't know how to fill those holes. We don't know policy. We don't have solutions. And they're right to some extent, because it's a lot harder. I'm way better at poking those holes. And I think we should be honest with ourselves about
that.
That being said, what I know is that nothing that's been put forward, we're about to enter our fourth administration at war. We're about to have the first time in American history that kids are going to turn 20 years old, having never been at peace, having been in a period of extended singular war, right? One continuous war. Nothing has worked. Militarism has worked, whether it was the polite imperialism of Obama or whether it was the overt imperialism of Bush or the bombastic and farcical imperialism of Trump. None of that has worked. And now we're probably going to go back to some sort of like Obama light with a little bit of more Scranton folksiness.
Yeah.
Right. And we know that none of that has worked. So I think for solutions, first of all, it requires a complete reframing of what American security means and what our threats are. And so if we completely reframe our threats and say that the two main threats are nuclear, you know, mishandling and a war that didn't need to be fought and can't be fought, because you can end the war in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Right. Russia and America. So what does that require? That requires cooperation. That requires living together in the world as it is, even if you don't, coexistence. And the other one is like climate catastrophe. So if you're in, if you believe in that science, right, then you understand that that also is going to require cooperation among the major powers who also have nuclear weapons. And then if you take that, then you should be driving most of your defense policy. And the key word there is defense, not offense, towards those goals. And again, no number of tanks is going to necessarily help that. So that's the first thing. Reframe the threats, reframe the notions of security. Understand you're going to live in a world of imperfect security. Terrorism is not going anywhere.
Yeah.
What do? We try to mitigate it by creating less of it. Create less of it by having a more restrained and humble foreign policy. You pull most forces out of these states and regions where we've really been banging our head against the wall and spinning wheels for so long. And to the extent that you remain involved, you do so with truly a non-military hand, not a military hand veiled in humanitarianism, as we often do. And so you lean on diplomacy, you lean on humanitarian aid to the extent that you want to be involved. This does not involve isolationism or just all those broad brushes that are thrown against us as pejoratives. You recognize the fact you have to face hard truths. And the hard truth that professors and scholars have understood for a long time, and nobody listens to them because nobody likes to hear what a geek has to say.
Yeah.
What we know is that forward expeditionary interventionism fails and is counterproductive. If you face that hard truth, which requires you to face the truth that maybe your country is not a force for good in the world all the time, or even most often, then that requires you to really do a paradigm shift. And I think that that philosophical shift is a practical one. The two are linked. I'm for pulling U.S. troops out of pretty much all existing conflict zones and doing everything possible to tamp down tensions with Russia and China, including things that other people would consider to be sort of, pulling back too much or enabling or encouraging other countries to take the lead. I want to avoid a catastrophe however possible, and I want to minimize the amount of anti-American sentiment that we cause. So that involves shutting the bases, bringing the troops home. Really, truly, I mean that. As simple as that.
And from a historical standpoint, like you mentioned this in Patriotic Dissent, if we, rather than just a moral argument against fighting unjustified forever wars, isn't there a historical precedent with basically nations that have collapsed in the past going hand in hand with expansionist imperialism, expansionist military action? Like, I mean, is there a practical threat to the U.S. if we continue doing this? Like bad repercussions that even your most ardent, stereotypical, like right wing, you know, go America person that you could explain to of like why it's, even if to that person, it's still a bad idea because there's practical negative repercussions that historically can be seen as happening.
Yeah. I mean, blowback is the most important term here.
Yep.
I should do an article on this, but probably everywhere that American soldiers have died in combat since 9/11, but definitely almost everywhere, to hedge, there is a backstory. I like backstory. I like context. There's a human interest element to it, and there's a sort of scholarly element to it. If you pull a thread on any of the countries that an American soldier has died in since 9/11, it's about a dozen. Pull that thread just a little bit, and you'll find that an American policy, often from the end of the Cold War, sort of created the conditions that necessitated or seemed to necessitate us invading, occupying, and being involved. We're still fighting wars ineffectively and making them worse, but we're still fighting wars in many cases that were caused by ill-advised policies that were not grounded in understanding of the region or the region's history from the Carter years, like Afghanistan.
Yep.
From the Carter and Reagan years, like Iran, Iraq. And of course, I'm referring to supporting the Mujahideen against the Russians. I'm referring to supporting Iraq's invasion of Iran, which may have been forgotten here, but is not forgotten in Tehran, where it was an existential threat. And then maybe a million Iranians died fighting to defend their borders while we sold materials and green lighted Saddam. So, you know, I just think if to show people, look, almost every single terrorist attack in the United States since the 1970s that was perpetrated by a foreign alien, right? By a foreign citizen. That citizen was a citizen of a country that the U.S. had meddled in effectively on our end, but had actually catalyzed enormous amounts of violence. Oftentimes there's a dead family member involved from their past, or just a general anger with American policy and its effect on their land. So yeah, backstory, backstory explains blowback. And I think that if you want to ride the subway safely in New York, you know, or you want to drive to Walmart safely in Ohio, it is important to pay attention to what your country does overseas. And it's done in your name. And that's what I tell people all the time. Whether you know it or not, whether you get drafted or not, whether you pay a war tax directly or not, this stuff is done in your name.
Yeah.
Those bodies are on us, all of us. I don't omit myself, by the way.
And then, so what is a better version? If somebody listening to this is thinking, but yeah, I want to be a patriot, I want to support America, what's an evolved version of that? Where, because it does always strike me that you can get into disagreements with people about what patriotism is. To me, it is never about supporting a particular candidate or a particular political party or the flag, which is another symbol. To me, when I look at it, the bare bones of what that we can all get to is the Constitution. But because that's essentially the only thing that truly kind of really makes America in the first place. But that's kind of an abstract. I mean, like, you can't just say like, yeah, just be loyal to the Constitution, a piece of paper, and always equate that to every situation. So what's a better way for the average person to look at what true patriotism should be?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the subject of my book. And, you know, I thought about throwing patriotism out with the baby water, you know, and without, you know, like a baby thrown out with the bathwater. And, you know, Bob Scheer, who had kind of given me the idea for the book, he said, the question that generated it was, is patriotism toxic, Danny? You know, he loves that. He loves saying stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then now I was like, I hedged, you know, I was like, no, I think that there's a brand of patriotism that we need to keep. And he was like, write it up. Then when I started trying to write it up, I was like, oh, maybe it is toxic. Maybe we need to just, maybe he's right. Maybe there's no book to write. It's going to be one sentence. Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, patriotism, to the extent that we can agree on it, is you take the aspirations for the country. And so the aspirations, who do we want to be? Most of us kind of agree on that. Most of us.
That's a
dangerous statement. Believe whether we believe that America has been this like settler colonial racist society, which it largely has, and therefore it's the worst, or whether we believe it's perfect and beautiful. Most of the time we agree on like the core that's behind that. We just disagree to the extent that we've lived up to it. So, you know, patriotism in that sense is participatory and principled. And that's what I call it in the book, a participatory, principled patriotism. And that means, you know, taking some action with your life to try to make the country better. Now, in certain times, that may well be putting your hand over your heart and saying, my country's doing great, but rarely. Yeah. And in times of crisis like this, it might require some dissent, hence patriotic dissent, where it becomes a duty and it's obscene not to.
Yeah.
So there's a long tradition of this. It's usually the minority and usually the people that engage in this patriotic dissent. Whether it's street protests or anti-war activism or you name it, usually in their day, they're very unpopular. And they're usually like branded communists or fascists or agents of another government or un-American or somehow secretly, you know, subversive. And then only later do they get holidays named after them, like Martin Luther King, right? Who was considered a communist in his day. And, you know, 75% of people polled at the time of his assassination had a negative view of him.
75. Yeah, that was amazing. I remember that from your book, and I was not aware of that.
Yeah, which is worse than it was 5 years earlier when only 50% were negative. And the people who turned, by the way, were polite liberals.
Yeah.
That's the difference. The right hated him always.
Yeah.
They always said he was a communist. What changed was with the riots in the cities that he refused to completely attack. He said, I'm against riots, but I think we have to understand why they happen. What's the root of it? And he said things like, listen, your white liberal friends are almost worse because they tell you they're your friend, but then they kind of want safety and security and privilege more than they want justice. When he started saying that, and when he went against the sacred cow of American capitalism, American militarism, whatever you think of, whether he was right or not, the white liberals turned on him.
Yeah.
That's that 25%. that pivoted. So, you know, I think what I'm saying here is that true patriotism has very little about what uniform you, very little to do with what uniform you wear, very little to do with flyovers at NFL games or hands over hearts or pledges or flags or all the other cosmetic and symbolic. It has a lot more to do with, you know, being active, organizing, and attempting through rhetoric or whatever tool is at your disposal to make the country live up to the values, even if it's never been there before. You know, so we've never been an egalitarian society. We've never been a racially colorblind society, but working towards it in incremental ways. And unfortunately, what we've done is we've made it more of a pageantry patriotism, as I call it, where it's the symbols that we focus on. We argue over the symbols like flags and flyovers and yellow ribbons. And we forget that what we really, what that all symbolizes is something deeper. So that's the patriotic.
Yeah. It's that focusing on the symbol rather than the nuance of really debating and discussing what should be the substance behind those symbols. Yeah. Well, hopefully people will read your book. It's a great book. You're a very good writer. It's very engaging and easy to get through in a couple of days, but will definitely make you think about a lot of stuff for a lot longer than that. And I really appreciate you coming on. Is there any other websites, anything else you'd like to mention while we've got you here?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd love the opportunity for that. You know, my website where everything I write ends up, every appearance like this that I do ends up, is skepticalvet.com. It's the same as my Twitter handle, @skepticalvet. And then I also co-host the podcast with a fellow veteran called Fortress on a Hill, where I do a lot of these conversations with brave voices. That's fortressonahill.com. So skepticalvet.com, all my work, and Fortress on a Hill.
Awesome. And we'll put links to that in the bottom as well.
Yeah, that's great. This is, I mean, this, your questions were excellent. And I'm really glad that you asked them. This was a really interesting conversation. So thanks.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Danny.
And there it is, everybody, our interesting and sobering conversation with Major Danny Sertion. And hopefully that gives you some things to think about. I don't think there is an easy answer to a lot of the questions we try to bring up on this show, like what is patriotism? But I think Danny would agree that the most important thing is for you just to start thinking about it more deeply. You don't have to necessarily agree with all the conclusions that he comes to, but or the conclusions that I come to. But what this show is about is trying to empower you to think about it objectively and not take other people's answers for yourself without questioning them. I think it's extremely fascinating, the stat that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that we haven't declared a war since World War II, yet as Danny explained to us, on any given day, we are probably operating with military action in around 25 different countries around the globe. And these do have real-world effects as far as potentially actually creating hostility against the U.S., as well as putting our soldiers in harm's way. And honestly, you know, potentially way more ramifications that we don't even know about. The point is that this hasn't been the way it's always been. And Danny's explanation of what the military-industrial complex is and the fact that a lot of these conflicts are going on not so much over democratic principles as to help someone's bottom line is an extremely troubling concept, but something that people need to be aware of and start to hold your elected leaders accountable to. Now, I will just clarify real quick, like I'm not saying that you need to be an anti-war activist right away. And honestly, I do believe military action is justified sometimes, but it's just
probably a lot fewer and farther between than the 25 countries we might be bombing right now that you and I don't know about. And that has not been normal throughout history. And military action is designed in our Constitution to be decided through Congress. So therefore, there can be a public debate about where we are using military action. It's not supposed to be up to just unilaterally the president or generals, or God forbid, even worse than that, some executive for Raytheon or some other weapons manufacturer deciding where we go bomb or send troops into. It's supposed to be something that is debated in our Congress by our representatives, so at least a majority of the country understands and supports our reasons for being there. So anyway, that's my two cents. Obviously, I defer to Danny and people who have on the ground combat experience, and someone like that has his extensive military history knowledge. Listen to him, and he is going to be able to give you a lot more tangible information than I will. But my job, I feel like, is just to help you raise the right questions. And this is definitely one of them. What is patriotism? What is the military-industrial complex? And what are the things we can do to help make things better going forward without siding on the red side or the blue side, but just in trying to make things overall better for everybody? And anyway, if you like this sort of independent thinking content, please consider supporting us through the Patreon link down below. You can actually get some video bonus footage to this interview with Danny in the patron section on Patreon, as well as a free t-shirt and free book if you sign up for the highest level. But whatever you do, wherever you are, keep thinking for yourself and check out Danny's book, Patriotic Descent, and we will hopefully see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Independent Riot Podcast, your home for free thinkers, independent believers, and radicals questioning the status quo. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please do us a huge favor and leave a quick positive review on whatever platform you're using. It's free to you and super easy to leave us a good ranking and really help spread the word about the podcast to other independent thinking folks. Thanks for listening, and please go ahead and subscribe so we can be sure to see you next time.